Welcome to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk. Here's your host, Jason Davis.
Good morning. Happy Friday. We are live. It is Soccer Morning, the day before. USA-Mexico tomorrow night, that will be the dominant feature of today's show. But man, there's a lot to cover. Big show for you today on the USA-Mexico tip. Our good friend Charlie Bohm from Soccer Wire, MLSsoccer.com and USsoccerplayers.com will join us in a couple of minutes. We'll preview the match with him. We'll get his thoughts on what Mexico might do. How much do we know about what Jurgen Klinsmann plans to do? Lots of questions surrounding this game. I don't know that we've ever had a more unsettled USA-Mexico combination heading into a big match between the two countries outside of a friendly where you get experimentation. So there's a lot to cover there. We will get to all of that. Plus your phone calls on the other side of Charlie's chat. Good stuff coming on a Friday edition of the program. I hope you're ready to go. If you're watching the video, you can see I'm game face is on. I'm rocking the USA jersey. Now it's the bomb pop. Maybe you're not a fan of the bomb pop. Whatever. It's what I got. It's what I like. Here we go. Let's hit the news ahead of Charlie Bohm getting on this program. Let's start with yesterday. Liverpool unveiling Jurgen Klopp as the club's next manager, 3-year deal reportedly. A couple of things, interesting things said by Jurgen Klopp at his introductory press conference. He is charming the pants off of Liverpool fans, off of the English media. This is no surprise. We know what kind of guy Jurgen Klopp is. If there's nothing else about him that makes him an attractive guy to root for, it's the things that he says. He said, here we go. On cutting his year-long, this is all transcribed over at worldsoccertalk.com, by the way, on cutting short his year-long sabbatical. I'm back in the race, and it's the biggest honor I can imagine. It is the perfect next step for me to be here to try to help. He says he is targeting a 4-year plan for a title for Liverpool. I don't want to describe myself. Does anyone in this room think I can do wonders? No, I am a totally normal guy. I am the normal one. Now, obviously, this is playing off of Jose Mourinho, his introductory press conference at Chelsea a decade ago, in which the Portuguese manager said, I am the special one. Just another thing that's going to endear Jurgen Klopp to the masses there on Merseyside. On how he wants to be thought of. When I left Dortmund, my last sentence was, it is not so important what people think when you come in. It is much more important what they think when you leave. Some amazing quotes here on his message to the players and fans. You have to change from doubters to believers. We have to start anew and see what happens this year. On his squad, this is a great club with big potential. Fast players, strong players, good defenders. Everything is there. 4 or 5 strikers you can work with when they are not injured. Midfielders, defenders are experienced and young. Goalkeeper is really good. He has paid his due respects to Liverpool and its history. Of course it is surreal. I have to accept it. I woke up this morning and I was manager of Liverpool FC. I am prepared, but of course this is absolutely crazy what has happened. This guy seems to be a normal guy who just happens to be a very excellent football manager. And a perfect fit, is that the way to say it here? A perfect fit for Liverpool FC. I don't know how else you could assess it at this point. Now, there is a lot of work to be done, as he said, but if there's anybody you can count on to put the work in and not make it about himself, it's going to be Jurgen Klopp. Does not guarantee success, and yes, there's a bit of overhyping happening here, but that's natural in the modern world. All things look good for Liverpool right now, save, of course, retooling the squad to play Jurgen Klopp's style of soccer, and that will come. European and South American qualifiers, European championships, World Cup qualifiers in South America, throwing up some very interesting results on Thursday night. Brazil starts with a 2-0 loss to Chile, without Neymar, of course, and a Messi-less Argentina loses at home 2-0 against Ecuador. Sergio Aguero hurt in that game, potentially out for a long period of time. Reports that it may even be a torn hamstring muscle. This is the first time in CONMEBOL history that Brazil and Argentina have lost on the same day. I saw another stat yesterday. Don't quote me on this. I'll have to verify it, but it said something like no team has qualified for the World Cup when losing their opening qualifier at home. Of course, that applies to Argentina. Wow. Ireland shocking Germany in European qualifiers, 1-0 on the back of a Shane Long goal. Just a long ball out of the back from the goalkeeper. Shane Long latches on, hits a great shot to beat the German keeper, and of course Ireland with a famous victory at home over the defending world champions. Scotland has been eliminated. That's not necessarily a surprise. They draw with Poland 2-2. Robert Lewandowski on fire at the moment, helps in the comeback for the Poles. European qualifiers today, nothing of real note. Couple of games, Spain, Luxembourg, you expect the Spanish to walk. England, Estonia, same thing. Slovenia, Lithuania, really, it is slim pickings today when it comes to those European qualifiers. So more reason for you to just get yourself ready for tomorrow. Sepp Blatter has appealed his 90-day FIFA suspension. He's lodged his appeal with the FIFA Ethics Committee. Klaus Stolker, Blatter's friend and advisor, told the press association, a sport, he has appealed already to FIFA's appeal committee. He is defending his position, and he is sure he will be found not guilty. Now, of course, this 90-day ban comes because of the investigation taking place into a $2 million payment given to Michel Platini nearly a decade after a contract to do work on behalf of FIFA for the Frenchman. Meanwhile, Platini also has said he will appeal his own ban. He has vowed that. And the UEFA president has retained the backing of the French Football Federation president, Noël Le Graët. Whether or not Platini is still a candidate for FIFA president come February, when that special election is held to replace that bladder, no one seems to know at the moment. Just be aware, everybody's going to appeal. In fact, saw this morning that the South Korean Chung is appealing his 6-year ban as well. That goes before the FIFA Ethics Committee, and then potentially for all of these guys, to the court for arbitration of sport. Lionel Messi and his father are facing tax evasion charges in Spain. There is a trial planned. A Spanish court ruled on Thursday that Lionel Messi and his father Jorge will stand trial for defrauding the Spanish tax authorities of more than $5 million. Despite prosecutors requesting charges be dropped, the judge has ruled that, quote, rational signs that the criminality was committed by both accused parties justified holding the case for trial. No trial date has been set, and attorneys representing Spanish tax authorities have said they will seek a 22-month jail sentence for both Messi and his father. Now, I have faith that this will resolve itself in some manner. There will be a settlement, something will happen, and Messi's not going to jail, but it certainly does not look good, and certainly does not look good for the image of Lionel Messi, who has had numerous missteps over the last couple of years in regards to his charity games, in tax cases like this, his father perhaps circumventing some rules and regulations in Spain to keep some of that money. As I mentioned, tomorrow night, Pasadena, California, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, USA-Mexico, the first ever CONCACAF Cup with a Confederations Cup berth on the line, sellout crowd of 93,000 expected at the Rose Bowl. Mexican interim head coach Tuca Ferretti faces a selection challenge, injuries throughout the squad, numerous attacking options. Is Rafa Marquez healthy enough to play the center of a 5-man back line? We'll see. The American back line has been a mess for a couple of years, and that's the challenge facing Jurgen Klinsmann. Tinkering ahead of this game for a long time now leaves a lot of questions as to what Klinsmann will do with his back line and then moving forward throughout his formation. We'll get into all of this with Charlie Bohm in just a second. In fact, let's go ahead and do that now. We'll step aside. We'll get our friend Charlie on the line. We'll talk USA-Mexico. Are you pumped? You ready? Okay, let's go. Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com.
Face in the crowd, you're talking too loud, but I can't hear you calling.
When it comes to the USA against Mexico, this game's different. As Michael Bradley puts it, the passion, the colors, the respect, the hate. Soccer Morning listeners, I'd like to invite you to join me and Jared Dubois this Saturday for the USA versus Mexico broadcast on Rabble.tv at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Pacific. With Rabble, the concept is simple. All you have to do is tune into the USA versus Mexico game on TV, press the mute button, and then head on over to Rabble.tv to listen to me and Jared on your desktop, through your iOS Android app, or through your mobile browser. Plus, before or during the game, you can join in by posting your questions or observations in the comments section. Or why don't you create your own broadcast? Call one of your team's games. It's easy. Sign up for free today. Try it out. Join me and Jared this Saturday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern for the USA versus Mexico on Rabble.tv, where it's your team and your call.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
We're back on Soccer Morning. We have gotten our friend Charlie Bohm from MLSsoccer.com and SoccerWire.com and USSoccerPlayers.com on the line. Charlie, that song, that's got a little bit of a psych-up feel to it, that Muse song there that I just brought us in with. Were you a psych-up music kind of guy?
During my own limited career, yes, for the most part, yes.
What was your because, you know, I actually didn't play soccer after the age of 12, so there wasn't a lot of music in my pregame ritual for soccer. But, you know, I played other high school sports, and there was always like groups of guys in the locker room. Some listening to this kind of music, some listening to the, I know you had some Caribbean excursions, so maybe it was that flavor. What was your music?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, it was important to be up tempo for the most of the crap levels I played at, you know, because it was a helter skelter sort of style between college and high school and so forth. But yeah, actually, being in an 18-passenger minivan with a bunch of teammates crammed in there, rolling through island roads on the way to a game somewhere in Grenada, there would be a lot of dance hall.
Yeah,
that was pretty good.
All right,
you
get that rhythm going, you get the blood pumping. I know, you know, like some people like heavy metal. That's obviously like you know, lots of vigor in it. Well, I don't know what the U.S. men's national team is listening to. I don't know what the Mexican national team are listening to. We don't know what they're going to look like tomorrow night. I think the place to start with this game is simply the uncertainty of what we're going to see in terms of lineups and formations from both sides.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I think, known unknowns, you might say, in this game, which is it's a fascinating situation. You have two coaches in really sort of diametric situations for this match. We have Jurgen Klinsmann, who is, despite a, you know, sort of growing tide of frustration with him among the fans, he's secure in his post. He's not judged on one game or one tournament or even one year, I think, at this point. And on the other side, Tuca Ferretti is certainly going to feel pressure, but he's an interim coach. He has been from the get-go by his own design as much as anyone else's. And his job is to get a result and then hand the reins over to Juan Carlos Osorio, who is making his move north from Brazil, a Colombian with MLS background who's going to be taking over the L3 program after this. So really interesting situation in that regard. And in the sense also that, so Ferretti is a short-term coach. He's probably not going to have time or inclination to make big changes to his squad and their shape and their approach. While Klinsmann, well, who knows? I mean, I think we're probably going to see a 4-4-2 tomorrow or some derivation. And you can write in with pen certain players on the roster, but, you know, the starting 11 is probably going to have at least one wrinkle to it that we're not expecting.
Well, let's start with, from the American side of things, let's start with the back line, because Klinsmann hasn't, I think the stat is he hasn't played the same back line for about 2 years now in any match, you know, consecutive matches. And that obviously leads into a lot of questions about whether they're ready to handle a stage like this against a team like Mexico that is notoriously good at breaking down. Well, they haven't been in recent times, but their ability to play the ball on the ground is obviously going to tax American defensive movement and organization. I'm looking at Matt Doyles, and that's a good guess as any. He's a smart guy. Fabian Johnson, Jeff Cameron, Matt Beasley, DeMarcus Beasley. And that sounds okay, but is that really, does that give you a lot of confidence?
Well, that's the thing is, you know, Jurgen's confidence and the nature of the way he expresses it is different from maybe a typical fan or a more predictable coach. He's really tried to make John Brooks and Ventura Alvarado his sort of pairing of the present / pairing of the future this year, even with some really uneven performances from those two. He doesn't have the choice with Brooks. He has to bring someone new in there, but is Alvarado still sort of a locked-on guy that he really trusts? He said nice things about him this week, even though he's not getting regular minutes at Club America of late. And then you have a couple guys with World Cup experience who are, you know, certainly in the mix. You know, there's a lot of options for him at center back, but it's still unclear what he's going to do. And I think the whole conversation about comfort zones and challenging players, now we sort of, with so much of that ringing in our ears, we don't really know what he's going to do in this situation. You know, he could pick a World Cup pairing, you know, guys that have played together in big games like this, or he could mix and match here. And he's been so prone to experimentation for months now, for really more than a year, that we're still left to guess at this point.
Okay, so let's, while admitting that there is some uncertainty as to what Tuco Ferretti will do with his front line, let's just consider what the strengths of the Mexican side. And because I think, you know, the logical thing is to expect a coach in a one-off game where you have to win to play a combination of defenders who are most adept at defending the other team's strength. You want to minimize Mexico's strengths. Is there a combination that does that? I mean, I understand why Alvarado gets a look. I mean, he's certainly better with the ball than most of the center backs the United States has. We know Klinsmann values that. But, you know, is there going to be a question of Mexico playing from wide positions and trying to put in crosses for Oribe Peralta, and now you need somebody to win the ball in the air? I mean, is there something there?
Well, what's fascinating, too, here is that the U.S. is generally perceived to be at a low ebb right now with the Gold Cup sort of catastrophe, and then some uneven performances since then, and yet Mexico's whole system could hinge on whether a 36-year-old defender is
right,
fully fit to play. Rafa Márquez remains a linchpin of this team, someone whose career is also, as Matt Doyle pointed out, as long as MLS has been in existence. You know, Rafa's been around forever, and yet if he's healthy, he'll go tomorrow, and he'll be probably at the heart of a 5-3-2 system that's a holdover from Piojo Herrera, Ferretti's predecessor. So, you know, if they don't have Márquez, if they decide that Márquez can't start, then they may be looking at a whole different formation and a whole different setup. A lot of analysis suggests that a 4-4-2 would be the alternative, which would significantly change the balance, the angles, the combinations that Mexico would be accustomed to. So I think Ferretti's going to turn to Márquez if he possibly can, just because he's not a gambler. He wants to try and keep this team playing the way they've played well in a 5-3-2. You know, they went toe-to-toe with Argentina earlier this fall. They were quite good in that sense. It's a system they're all familiar with. So, you know, and then if we look further ahead, they have a sort of – they're spoiled for choice up top in a way that U.S. fans should be envious of. You know, Oribe Peralta, who's not a fan favorite for El Tri, but is someone that I think Tuca trusts, a big guy that Javier Chicharito Hernandez can run off of. That may be a strike pairing. That's the talk we're hearing in some quarters. But he's also got guys like Tecatito Corona, and there's just a range of options, you know, for Ferretti. The hot rumor yesterday was, I think it was ESPN's John Sutcliffe was reporting that there would be a 4-3-3 formation for Mexico, with Rafa actually playing as a number six, playing as a holding midfielder, which would be a very attacking oriented shape. It would definitely create the possibility for a lot of goals, but it leaves gaps in the back that could easily be exploited. And you know, you have to, I think in this rivalry, you have to remember the dominant history of late is the U.S. winning these games almost no matter what the circumstances are coming in. They won earlier this year in San Antonio. Jurgen Klinsmann remains undefeated against Mexico as a coach, and then going back further as a player with Germany. So there's so many fascinating inputs here that it really is hard to know what we're going to see on the field and then how the game's going to play out. The challenge, I think, for Mexico is prove that your superior form, your superior talent pool is actually means something in this game, because it hasn't for more than a decade now. you know, they, it's on them, I think, to seize the initiative to change the narrative of this game right from the opening whistle.
It just, it seems that, you know, again, putting into play everything that's uncertain for the U.S. and some of the, a lot of that's, you know, created by Klinsmann, but also by some questionable performances and guys not rising to the necessary level. But it's not really the stage for Mexico to make that statement. I mean, they're not, again, they're have no continuity coming into this match because of the coaching change. I guess if well, again, not knowing what Mexico is going to do, and you identify potential 4-3-3 per John Sutcliffe, if that's Rafa Márquez as a six in a 4-3-3, then what do the Americans have that exploits, you know, those spaces, as you mentioned, that space right there in front of that back line?
Yeah, and you know, I should also point out, there's, you know, Sutcliffe is a great journalist, but there are those who question this just based on personality. You know, Piojo was the type of guy that would not only release, he would tweet out his starting 11 sometimes a day or more before kickoff. Whereas Ferretti's a little bit more of a canny gamesmanship type guy who keeps his cards close to his chest. So the idea is also circulating that this whole thing is a calculated leak for, you know, disinformation purposes. If they do somehow come out in that 4-3-3, which I would be still somewhat surprised by, I think, you know, forcing Rafa to cover significant amounts of ground behind a bunch of attacking players is going to leave spaces that guys like, I think, Dempsey and Altidore and Bradley can exploit. If you leave that zone 14 open, or if you pile the responsibilities of defensive cover on a 36-year-old's legs, you're certainly asking for to get countered on. You're asking to give up chances, and you're forcing your two center backs to probably make some tough decisions. And guys like Dempsey are very good at floating into that space, into the hole there, and maybe combining and forcing those defenders to make bad decisions. So I think, again, ideally, Mexico is going to want that 5-3-2 because they've been so defensively stable from there, and that allows them to play to the strengths out wide. You know, if we see that formation with guys like Layún rampaging forward, getting involved in the attack on the overlap, I think that's a tough matchup for the U.S. because we expect them generally to play a sort of a narrowish 4-4-2. That's been Klinsmann's favorite formation of the past year. And that forces guys to float wide. It requires good communication between fullbacks and midfielders who may or may not have that level of fluency and understanding right at the moment.
That 4-4-2 that Klinsmann has deployed before, especially without Alejandro Bedoya potentially missing out. I think there's a word that...
He's missed training with illness this week. So I think maybe two trainings at this point.
Yeah, and even okay, so potentially Jossie Zardes in the midfield. I think we might all expect to see that. There is always the potential that a surprise like DeAndre Yedlin could be in there. But it's when you say narrowish, just break that out for me, because it seems to me that it is. And I'm not the tactics guru, but as much as it might be narrowish, it's also unbalanced, especially if Jermaine Jones is playing one of those quote unquote wider positions.
Right, and I think that was the main reason we saw Klinsmann experiment with it in the lead up to last summer's World Cup. With Jermaine Jones, you have this wild card who is a defensive mid or a number eight, a box to box by trade, but his nature is to run everywhere that he sees fit and to cover ground and wreak havoc and try and make plays. And that forces those around him to compensate a little bit. There's positives and negatives to it. So if we see Jermaine, for example, he's played kind of a pinched left-sided role designed to give him that freedom. DeMarcus Beasley is smart enough and is trusted to be able to cover that spot for him, to help him on the overlap as needed. And then, but of course, U.S. teams traditionally are not the type of teams that are going to use the diamond the way, for example, Real Salt Lake did, to keep possession, to build, to make the opponents chase. They still are going to need wits from somewhere. So we'll be looking at Fabian Johnson coming wide is from the fullback spot, most likely. Jossie Zardes, I expect, will be given a start probably at right midfield if Jermaine's on the left. So those two guys are going to be expected to stretch the play more to the right. So kind of a skinny diamond or lopsided shape that, you know, you hope you're hiding your deficiencies and accentuating your attributes that way. And we all might also see Yedlin. Yedlin's a long shot, I think, to start, but he could well start. He started the last couple of games for them, I think, and certainly I think he'll be one of Jurgen's top options off the bench to bring width and verticality out there on the right.
Now, that's mostly going forward. DeMarcus Beasley, Fabian Johnson having a role to play in the attack, creating those overloads, giving options to Bradley, who's going to be asked again to be a distributor and a creator. But defensively, again, not knowing what Mexico is going to do, finding it unlikely they're going to play a 4-3-3, where is the support? Again, especially with a back line who has not played together because no American back line has played together.
Yeah, so then if you're going to play Jermaine in kind of a go-anywhere role, that requires someone to cover for him. It seems like Kyle Beckerman would be the most likely guy, the one who has the most big game experience to play that out-and-out six holding role. The question is, you know, is Beckerman still the best option there? I think if you use Klinsmann's criteria in other regards, then you would see someone like Danny Williams, who's playing at a higher level, who's excelling in the English second division. And again, we have this balance here between Klinsmann has consistently been, you know, sort of publicly warning his older players, of which Beckerman is one, that this could be their last call-up, this could be their last big game, the generational shift is coming. So is he ready to do that now? I don't think he's ready to do that across the field, but there may be one or two places where he decides it's time to turn the page, and that defensive midfield role may certainly be one of them. I personally think that playing two defensive mids with, you know, Michael Bradley in one of those deeper roles and allowing him to dictate from deep and pick his moments to get forward, I think that's where this team is most effective, in more of a 4-2-3-1 type shape. But Jurgen has clearly decided that Michael Bradley's his best role in advanced midfield, and so I think we'll see him there. The question is just giving Bradley the backing to be able to move around as he sees fit and to dictate and influence the game.
The difference between, the skill sets between Kyle Beckerman and Danny Williams. Beckerman, a better passer, probably a better decision maker. Certainly he's great with a tactical foul. If you need one, he can hold the ball. I mean, maybe the best six at holding the ball still in the American system. I mean, that's why he's had such a long run under Klinsmann. Whereas Danny Williams is going to give you what? More ground cover, more ability to track back if necessary if Mexico gets on a break.
Yeah, again, it's a sort of a fundamental conflict, or maybe just a dualism of the Klinsmann era. We talk about playing more intelligently and letting the ball do the work and that sort of thing, and yet athleticism remains a huge focus, and with some justification, you know, given the challenges of the international level. But Landon Donovan, for example, said that the U.S. has done best against Mexico when it dictates the tempo, when it forces Mexico to play at a higher pace, when it doesn't allow for that sort of deliberate buildup. If they do pick that higher pace, then that puts challenges on Beckerman. Beckerman is not the athlete that Danny Williams is. And we see when games turn into track meets, that often doesn't play to Beckerman's strength. It'll force him maybe out of his comfort zone. I think he can do it if he plays one and two touch and has good numbers around him to help keep the ball. But Williams is someone who can run a bit more, who can make up for the mistakes of others with his legs, whereas Beckerman has to do it with his brain. So two different attributes there. The experience, I think, really counts too. Williams is still relatively inexperienced at the international level. But if the Mexicans get numbers into the danger zones in and around the U.S. box, that's going to be tough for someone like Beckerman. And he's shown in the past that it challenges him in a way that forces him into, you know, silly fouls and giving up poorly placed free kicks. So a lot of, I think, an important decision there for Klinsmann, and one that we still just aren't quite sure what his thinking is.
All right, barring a scoreless, goalless draw that goes into extra time and into penalties, they need to score to win, Charlie. And, we talked a little bit already about Clint Dempsey, maybe Jozy Altidore, Michael Bradley exploiting some space if Mexico goes with a surprising attacking lineup. But regardless of how Mexico plays, the United States is going to have to pick some guys who can put the ball in the net. Lots of questions about Jozy. Lots of questions about I get asked and called about his work ethic and his effort all the time. Charlie, give me an assessment of that first, and then we'll sort of talk about the combinations possible and whether or not we might see a surprise. And if not, then who's coming off the bench to give that invigoration if need be?
Yeah, well, you know, Josie's probably for a program that has a history of talented enigmas. He's maybe the most prominent one that's in the squad at the moment. His talent is undoubted. His scoring rate, even in what he himself acknowledges is a little bit of a down year and a down time for him, he's still banging in the goals at a quality rate for Toronto FC. He's still maybe the most gifted striker on paper in the national team pool. And yet, you know, we're never quite sure of late, at least what we're going to get from him. And certainly he's had health issues. His hamstrings have been very problematic for him for a couple of years now. And then he spoke in general terms with, I think it was Jeff Carlisle of ESPN FC, about personal problems, stuff off the field that's affected his game for the last few months or longer. So I think Josie probably becomes a stalking horse when we talk about him in the media or when fans analyze him. He becomes something more than just one player. He's a little bit of a litmus test, I think, for certain people about what they think of the program, what they think of the team, and the, you know, the nature of American players. It's often hard to tell where his head is at, but when he is made at the, you know, put at the center of things with the national team, when he's supported well by his teammates, when he gets service, he's productive. And I don't think that this team, as much as we might like for Jurgen to be more daring in this respect, to try some new guys. Some of the guys that are scoring overseas that look like they bring similar tools but are younger and have less baggage. I still think we're going to see Josie in the 11, and the question becomes who delivers him the ball. Can he and Bradley strike up, you know, the well honed understanding they have? So it's yet another sort of known unknown here. But you know, I think Josie's track record and his mindset is such that he'll be ready to step up in a big game like this. But a striker in his position, you know, needs his teammates to really shine and really grab this game.
Dempsey's going to start. That's a given. Probably Josie's going to start. 99% sure of that. And therefore, it's on these guys again. You mentioned the Klinsmann sort of setting the stage for some of the older guys to move on and for a new generation to come in. It, moving beyond this game, win or lose, do you think that Klinsmann, because we know Klinsmann's going to have his job, do you think that Klinsmann is using this as a marker and that we will see a transformation? I mean, they go into World Cup qualifying. Well, there is a game next week, but they go into World Cup qualifying shortly, and yet the group is not what you would call it ultimately challenging, even with TNT in there. And he has some freedom to really refresh things. Is that what you expect?
Well, I think Klinsmann was being honest and he was speaking frankly there. But the problem is he's been saying that for more than a year now. He's been saying it for a couple of years. And yet he continues to, even after 18 months or so of experimentation and mixing up squads, trying new rosters or new formations, you know, he's tried all these different things to refresh the player pool and turn the page on the previous generation, but the previous generation are still getting called in. They're still the dependable ones. So, you know, we may hear more of this. We could hear this for months to come, and it doesn't necessarily mean that players aren't going to get called in. Sort of, you know, he does have a track record maybe of there's one or two high profile surprise call-ups or surprise snubs in his rosters. So going forward, you know, he may try to make an example out of someone. He may see a place where it's, you know, it's a good time to bring in someone new. But he feels, I think he gives the impression of a coach who feels limited and constrained by his talent pool. He's sort of has this, I think, complex algorithm that he's navigating by feel between MLS players who are playing regularly at what he considers a lower level and what many would say is a lower level, compared to Europeans who are getting, you know, limited minutes and fighting for spots. You know, I've been told by U.S. soccer officials that there is a balance there, that some players come in physically ready to meet the challenges of national team duty. And a bench role in Europe may make you more physically ready than even an everyday starter in MLS. So I think he's got to balance those things out. And maybe if this Olympic team, these U23s that are doing pretty well right now in qualifying, and if they get the job done, and let's not forget, that's another U.S.-Mexico match we may have coming up on Saturday in Olympic qualifying. just a few hours before the big CONCACAF Cup game. If some of those guys impress Klinsmann enough, that, you know, we may see them called in further down the road. But I don't think there's going to be any one landmark moment where the roster suddenly changes or the approach suddenly changes, because that actually hasn't been Klinsmann's tradition based on his actions more so than his words. So.
Okay, yeah, the USU-23s, by the way, play Honduras tomorrow in the semifinals of that. If they beat Honduras, they're in the Olympics, but then they would very likely have a final in that tournament against Mexico coming up next week. Fitness, Charlie, you hit on it, and my brow furrows a bit, because U.S. soccer officials behind the scenes, and we certainly know Klinsmann puts a lot of emphasis on fitness and talking about whether or not a bench guy in Europe is more ready than a guy who plays every day. This has not been that big of an issue before for MLS players. Why is it an issue now? And again, this is a guy who has a reputation or has earned a reputation for driving his players maybe a little too hard in camps, and then leading into games, they show signs of fatigue. It's a very subjective thing, but it certainly looks like they're tired in games where they shouldn't be.
It's true. It's a yet another sort of strange a little bit of irony or oxymoron in his time with the team. I think that, again, the rhetoric doesn't always match up to the actions, and some of that is by choice. You know, folks have made a good point in print this week about how Klinsmann comes from a country where the tradition is not necessarily to say what you're thinking when you have microphones in front of you. You know, maybe there's mind games going on here where he's projecting, he's communicating with his players, he's trying to create disinformation, even when speaking and presenting a sort of this informative, educational, technical director side of him, where he called 2015 the year of education and that sort of thing, right? And I think we have to just stop taking his words at face value, simply because history has shown that that's not the right approach. If this team had shown a genuine commitment to a high press, to a high tempo sort of style, then the fitness talk would make more sense. You know, I think if he had gone a little bit further and backed up his own talk about proactivity and seizing the control of matches, then it would make a little more sense to see this. You know, Peter Vermees at Sporting KC talks about sporting fit. His players need months to adapt to a whole different definition of fitness because they're trying to get into the other team's half and force turnovers and create havoc by high pressing. You know, Jurgen Klopp, who just got unveiled as a new Liverpool manager, his definition of fitness is fundamentally different, because if he continues his gegenpressing style that we saw at Dortmund, that's going to require new levels of effort and commitment and fitness from his Liverpool players. With Klinsmann, he's been a pragmatist when it comes down to it in must-win games like this one we have coming up tomorrow. He doesn't fundamentally change the structure or the intent of his team, and US-Mexico games almost always play out this way. The US defends and breaks, often to good effect, while Mexico possesses and probes and tries to break down a packed defense. So again, I've got to see more action in terms of, you know, what this whole focus on fitness really means. So again, maybe he's trying to do things and he's running up against walls that he cannot do too much about. But at some point here, I think even his supporters are eager to see a fundamentally different style that he picks and sticks with and moves forward with, and picks players that fit it ideally. Right now, he's trying to pick the best players he can, and he's still left sort of fundamentally adapting to what he has rather than imposing what he wants.
All right. So let's very quickly just to sort of sketch out what we think, or the best guess we can make about tomorrow. It's unlikely that a guy like Tuca Ferretti comes out with some freewheeling, super attacking formation and tactical plan like maybe a Piojo would do. And we know Klinsmann is unpredictable, but do you think this game is more likely to be an open game, say, you know, like that 2011 final that everybody points to, Bob Bradley's last game in charge? Or are we going to see sort of a slugfest that ends up being, even if it's 2-1, maybe set pieces, maybe penalties?
Oh, the 2011 game you referenced was ended pretty brutally from a U.S. standpoint. So I don't think they want that. I think actually Jurgen will do anything within his power to prevent it from turning into an end-to-end sort of a game, because that really suits the Mexicans. And the U.S. is a team that wants to control where and how this game is played. They want to be able to lure in El Tri and then expose gaps when they get forward. You know, especially if it's a partisan pro-Mexican crowd, as most people expect, despite CONCACAF's ticketing policies, they're going to be urged on by their fans, and there's an energy that comes from that's very positive for Mexico, but it can also be dangerous for them because they can be reckless, they can overcommit numbers into the attack. So I think the U.S. wants that to happen. They want this game to play out very similarly to how previous rivalry games in this series have gone. So I think you're asking for trouble, and you're asking for your team to do something that fundamentally doesn't play to their strengths if you try and go toe-to-toe and get into a slugfest with one wave of attacks after another. I think the U.S. is going to grind this one. They're going to try and impose physicality and domination in midfield with guys like Jones and probably Bradley, you know, getting stuck in, trying to win balls and set a tone early. And of course, we know refereeing is going to play a big role in that as well. I think it's Joel Aguilar, experienced CONCACAF referee, I think is the guy in the middle for this one. Much will depend on him. He's handled these U.S.-Mexico games in the past. He's often been a little bit lenient in terms of cautions and bookings and that sort of thing. So if he decides to crack down on this one, or if he doesn't like what he sees and he starts handing out cards, that could change this game as well quite easily. And I'm sure that we'll have at least one or two contentious decisions or non-decisions in the penalty boxes as well.
I'm glad we've done 20 minutes on what to expect, what we might see, what the formations might be, even with all of this uncertainty, because so much of this week has been dominated by what Landon Donovan said and the very question, Charlie, of whether or not Jurgen Klinsmann's job should be on the line based on this game. Do you have an opinion on that, or do you have some thoughts on, first of all, Landon Donovan's role as a provocateur these days, and again, the very notion of Klinsmann and his job security?
Well, whether he did it meant to or not, Klinsmann's public statements have had this amazing effect of sort of polarizing his viewership and the fan base, because he said the right things at the right times about everything from the youth system to promotion relegation to Europe versus MLS. He has, with just a few smart words or provocative words here and there, he's drawn really dedicated support, in some cases unquestioned support from big chunks of the fan base who see things in meta terms and aren't that interested in game by game results. Whereas the people who are paying more attention to the matches themselves, that want to see something closer to full fluidity and full performance relative to potential from the current team, I think are more likely to be frustrated because all of the fiddling and the tinkering hasn't really amounted to much since the World Cup. So it's very difficult to have a straightforward discussion about Jurgen Klinsmann. But look, he's not going to get fired on the basis of this result or any one result. I don't think between now and 2017, 2018, it would take a truly disastrous run of bad results in qualification, something that legitimately endangers the U.S.'s place at Russia 2018. Yeah. I think for Sunil Gulati to even consider going back on his steadfast, vocal, consistent support of Jurgen. He's brought in Jurgen to be a number of things, and that's probably kind of part of the problem, is we're not really sure how to evaluate him. But what matters the most is Sunil Gulati's opinion and Dan Flynn's opinion, the two guys that run U.S. soccer, and they're nowhere near the same mindset as the sections of the fan base that have turned against Klinsmann. So I think, you know, Landon's remarks are the sort of thing that get us tittering, but they really shouldn't, because in mature soccer nations, as Hercules Gomez pointed out, this is perfectly normal for players to ex-players, you know, along with pundits and journalists and fans, to express their opinion and point things out here. It should be, I think we should be in a little more pressure-packed environment. That in and of itself is what Jurgen has asked us to do, is to be more questioning, to raise our expectations, to be more demanding. So, you know, and I think that's great on Klinsmann's part, even if it sets him up to be a victim of his own messaging. But again, I think we're far from that point. This game is important. It's a huge game as a rivalry game. Both teams have decided that Confederations Cup matters a great deal, so therefore it does. And this result isn't going to put Klinsmann out by any means. I think we're months or years away from any concept of a true hot seat
for just to put a timeline on what you're saying. He's not going to get fired because of this result. If they lose, they've got fourth round qualifying with Trinidad and Tobago, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and Guatemala in their group. Unless they fall apart in a manner that no U.S. team has ever fallen apart, even under Jurgen Klinsmann, they're going to be fine. That means he's unlikely to face any real pressure until the hex. And even then, it's probably well into the hex, talking mid-2017, early 2017, before there's any real pressure based on results. So let's just put that out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's no – again, I think people are speaking more about what they would like to see or what they think should be happening in terms of the significance of this result. But, Klinsmann is in the driver's seat here. He has effectively become the federation. He's indispensable in a number of ways. He has been given the keys and he's driving this car. So, and you're right. The second round of CONCACAF qualifying doesn't look particularly daunting for the U.S. They've rarely struggled against Caribbean teams in for decades now. So, I think he'll even have leeway to continue if he wants to continue with the tinkering and the constant change and all that sort of thing. He can probably do that even during World Cup qualifying because they've got a lot of things breaking in their favor for months to come.
We'll see what happens tomorrow night in Pasadena, California. Charlie Boehm joining us on Soccer Morning. Go find him on Twitter, CBOEHM, MLSsoccer.com, SoccerWire.com, USSoccerPlayers.com. There's good stuff from Charlie in all three of those places, like right this second. I've read stuff, Charlie's stuff over the past week in all of those spots. They're all great. Thank you very much for the time, Charlie. We'll see what happens tomorrow night.
Indeed. Always a pleasure, Jason.
There goes Charlie Boehm. Good stuff from him. Let's take a break. We have the phone lines open ahead of a big USA-Mexico game. Give us a call, 646-832-3909. We'll be right back. Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com. When it comes to the USA against Mexico, this game's different. As Michael Bradley puts it, the passion, the colors, the respect, the hate. Soccer Morning listeners, I'd like to invite you to join me and Jared Dubois this Saturday for the USA versus Mexico broadcast on Rabble.tv at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Pacific. With Rabble, the concept is simple. All you have to do is tune into the USA versus Mexico game on TV, press the mute button, and then head on over to Rabble.tv to listen to me and Jared on your desktop, through your iOS Android app, or through your mobile browser. Plus, before or during the game, you can join in by posting your questions or observations in the comments section. Or why don't you create your own broadcast, call one of your team's games. It's easy. Sign up for free today. Try it out. Join me and Jared this Saturday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern for the USA versus Mexico on Rabble.tv, where it's your team and your call.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
Here we are back on a Friday edition of Soccer Morning, closing out a big week of shows with a bit of a preview. USA-Mexico, well, not a bit of a preview, a big preview. USA-Mexico coming up tomorrow night. Biggest game on the calendar for sure. Now, the United States could have avoided this if they had won the Gold Cup, but I don't want to revisit that whole debacle, so let's just move on. Ray in Milwaukee, what's going on, my friend?
Hey, man. You know what I like about this rivalry and what I find unique about this rivalry is that you've really seen the development of two soccering countries become globally competitive at the international level and taking both different approaches and getting there and everything else that comes into it. When the biggest myth about Mexican football is that it was a high quality of football for a very long time. It's actually been seen tremendous growth within itself, and I would say this is the best Mexican soccer has ever been.
Fair enough. I think that there's something to be said for the two countries pushing each other. Maybe Mexico does not get better. Maybe Mexico doesn't take steps forward. Maybe Mexico's talent identification and the number of good players they send to Europe doesn't reach this level without the United States pushing them, without MLS coming on the scene, certainly. But even more than that, just the national team rivalry. But at the same time, Ray, don't you think it's true that these are perhaps across the world? I mean, there are dips and troughs for other countries, certainly big ones. I mean, the Dutch have taken one recently. They may be eliminated from European championships tomorrow or this weekend. At the same time, don't you feel as though these two countries, in a big picture sense, are two of the more underachieving nations when it comes to this sport?
Yes, I would agree. But I think that's more on player development. I think that if you look at it, Liga MX, their answers, their big club teams, I think, have an answer of buying an Argentine player, buying a Colombian player, and even now, somewhat even buying an American player. And the United States' youth system development is that pay-to-play system, and that's always going to limit your player pool.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. There are intrinsic problems in both countries that need to be worked out. And I do think both have made big strides, obviously. I mean, just in terms of, for Mexico, it's becoming more efficient with things, and certainly the money coming to the game. Well, that's, as you mentioned, maybe buying Argentine players isn't always the best idea for Mexican talent. It has improved Liga MX and has improved those big clubs.
Right.
It allowed them to go down into Copa Libertadores and be more competitive. And at the same time, the United States is still just trying to figure out how to do this thing. And I'll throw it out there again, as I always do. The thing we don't want to accept is that all of this takes time, and we're just not willing to accept that.
Right. And I've always said that that if you look at, there's a reason why the last World Cup winners have all been European, and the style and how they've gotten there. It's such a massive hurdle. These literally guys play all year round at the same team. You're playing literally a traveling team with the Bayern Munich and Barcelona's, that what they've been able, what were they able to do with Spanish football and German football. Mm-hmm. You know, Messi himself could not carry a team. And I really believe that if Messi was, you know, if this was 86, Messi would have won in Brazil.
Right.
But, that's just a massive challenge.
The crucible, certainly this is true for Germany, and it obviously it's true for Spain as the 2010 champions. Even if you go back, I mean, maybe 2006 with Italy, certainly an Italy team that was not overly impressive in their victory. 2002 Brazil, the last time a South American team won. What we're seeing now is, and what you're talking about with these European teams, is that the crucible of big club soccer has refined the talent development in those countries and allowed them to become ascendant national teams. The reason Germany is so good right now, Raphael Hungenstein has a book out about it. They reformed their system, and that, so much of that came through the clubs. I mean, While we look at the U.S. national team program, we want to throw criticism around, or we want to throw praise around, or we want to say this is good, this is bad, look at these kids, look at the performance of our U-20s. Oh my God, they crashed out at this level, or they didn't win this thing, or oh look, they're winning. It's like a cross-section of what we really, what the real picture is, and that's the individual development across many different places of these players in club environments. And the problem is, it's not a problem, but it's a difference, Ray. It's in Spain. Spanish kids grow up in their hometowns. They go play for their local club. They get scooped up by the bigger regional club. Maybe one day they play for Barcelona, Real Madrid. Maybe not. Maybe they're just playing for Sevilla or Villarreal. These are all still great clubs. And they because they need to make money but through the sale of players, because of the competitive nature, not having the resources to buy players, they need to get better with development. They've created this machine that pumps out great players. The same thing for Germany, with more of a pre-programmed sort of idea. Let's do this thing to make this happen. The United States is in a position now, Ray, and this is just maturation, where so much of the development that happens with our players is either dependent on a very young MLS Academy system, a youth club system that, as you mentioned, is pay to play and limits access and probably doesn't have the level of coaching necessary to get kids where they need to go, or kids who go abroad. So it's this widespread, disparate thing that's happening all across the world rather than, and again, even looking at like a country like Belgium. They've managed to kind of bring this stuff all in-house. Not all of it. There are still kids leaving Belgium at 15 to go play in France or Germany or whatever. But they've still managed to find a way to make that system within their own country as efficient as it can possibly be with their constraints, and it's paying dividends. And I don't know how we get there. I'm not even saying that this is that there's blame to go around, because I think this is just something you have to find. You have to work to break down existing walls to figure out ways to get around these problems.
Right. I would agree with that. And going to the game, a lot of people have said, well, you got to go with what works. You got to go with what works. You look at the 0-0 draw and at the Azteca, or the 2-0 win in Columbus. And you got to go with these players. And I would say that is true. I think that's the best way to win. But this is that Mexico team was also a 0-0 draw against Jamaica. Chepo de la Torre's unwillingness to change tactically cost him his job. And if you look at it, he doesn't even have a job right now because of his tactics, in my personal opinion. And then the two guys that we talk about the game in Columbus, the two guys that scored that night, right, are no longer playing competitive soccer. So, when you talk about repeating the past, I think that's something that's, we got to take the good with the bad. And the ultimate bad, sad thing about this is that Miguel Herrera had never got to play Jurgen Klinsmann with a full roster and with time. And so it's kind of disappointing. It's kind of anticlimactic, in my personal opinion, because I love Miguel Herrera.
Well, we'll see what happens, Ray. I mean, there is a transition. The United States is always in a transitional period, it seems. Thanks for the call. Because the country is a burgeoning soccer country, not a established soccer country. That just comes with the territory. We're always working through a problem. We're always trying to figure out what our best style is. We're always working through a player pool that is alternately getting better or a disaster. I mean, Mark Fishkin's on Twitter this morning while I was talking to Charlie Bohm asking if we're in a talent trough. 5 or 6 years ago, most of our starters were starting regularly in Europe. Today, not so much. Does that equate to a lack of talent or a talent dip? And these things are not necessarily going to be always on the up. There's going to be hills and valleys. Although I think that overall the trend is upward, certainly in the numbers. And the more numbers you have, eventually that's going to pay dividends, and you're going to get better talent out of it. I think that there's a new generation coming through that's very exciting. We don't know if it's going to deliver, but at least there's something there. So we'll see what happens tomorrow night. But tomorrow night is not a referendum. And, look, if it's not going to be a referendum on Jurgen Klinsmann, let's not make it a referendum on the state of the U.S. national team program either. Let's go to Daniel, who wants to change the subject. What's going on, Daniel?
I'm kidding. I don't want to change the subject. Tell me, what's the biggest difference between the U.S. national team and the Mexican national team?
The biggest difference? I would say culture, probably.
I would say coaches.
Okay.
I think the U.S. wins this, no matter what. They've got in the past 4 years, how many head coaches they've changed, because a result didn't go well or a result, didn't go their way. The U.S., they stuck with Klinsmann. Even if they lose this match, which, would be pretty awesome if they won, go to the Confed Cup. They haven't been to one in years.
Well, yeah. There's only been one since they went to South Africa. Yeah, but there's only been one since then. I mean, Mexico went to it in the Confederations Cup in 2013. But that there's only been one. I mean, it is only a 4 year. So when you say they haven't been to one in years, that means they missed one of them. But just go ahead.
Well, Yeah, no, yeah, I meant, yeah, that's what I meant. By years, I meant like literal years.
Right, I understand. I'm sorry, did I derail you, Daniel? I didn't mean to. I apologize. I mean, what are you expecting? What are you expecting tomorrow night?
I'm expecting the U.S. win. I'm expecting, you know, for the U.S. to bunker down and hit on the counter. That's what I'm expecting.
Okay. I don't... Maybe. I don't know that bunker is going to be the word, Daniel. I think that, you know, they'll sit. They'll sit, but bunker to me implies, you know, 10 guys behind the ball. I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think they're going to park the bus. I don't think Mexico is in a position to force the United States to park the bus, in my mind. I don't think that that's – I think you're going to see a back-and-forth game. I think it's going to be physical. It always is. I think it's going to be intense. It always is. I think there will be missed chances. There always are. And I think it comes down to, you know, probably one call or two, a set piece, and you know, who takes that one really good chance. I think it could be 2-1 either way, is in my mind.
Is the U.S. playing a one-man or a two-man strike? What do you think?
They're gonna play a 4-4-2 with Dempsey dropping. So you want to call that a one striker setup? Then you can do that. But Dempsey's certainly going to be trying to get closer, as close to outdoor as he can with the ball. So it's a two striker setup with the caveat that Dempsey likes to drop deep to pick up the ball.
You totally made me lose what I was going to say earlier.
Well, I'm sorry, Daniel, and I can't wait around for you. I got Eddie in Brooklyn waiting. Thanks for the call, man.
Yeah, no problem. All right. Yeah, take it easy.
There goes Daniel. I apologize. I'm not trying to kill your thought process. I know I'm not going to have any problems. Eddie, what's going on, man?
Hey, what's up? You're not derailing my phone for playing that right now.
No, I know that. I know that.
Who do I root for tomorrow?
Man, I think you root for you can't root for death and destruction, but that's the proverbial, you know, sinkhole swallows the whole stadium situation for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not that sadistic. It's just like I figured I was gonna root for the U.S., but then U.S. soccer didn't release Matt Miazga in time. Eligible for Wednesday's game, so now we're gonna lose him for an extra game because he wasn't gonna play that game anyway. But at least he would have been there early enough for him to get a suspension out the way.
I'm kind of back and forth on this, Eddie. I understand why the Red Bulls are upset. But at the same time, they were trying to game the system a little bit. I mean, he's in a team that's still playing in a tournament. Let's not act like the tournament was over and they held him around for training camp and kept him from playing for the Red Bulls. He wasn't going to play. It was all about serving one game of a suspension. No, if there was an agreement in place and they went back on it, Eddie, then that's a different story.
As I'm saying, let's not act like the Red Bulls weren't doing U.S. soccer a favor because they don't really have to release these kids. These weren't FIFA dates.
No, but it's
not mandatory.
And for me, this is part of MLS maturation. If either MLS is going to serve the interest of U.S. soccer or the U.S. soccer program, and it's going to be all kumbaya, we're all in this together, or we're going to have an MLS that acts truly independent. I actually think a truly independent MLS is more fair to the fans, like you, and it's probably better for soccer overall. If the Red Bulls said, we can't lose Matt Miazga, we got a supporter shield in play, we're trying to get first place in the East, we want home, we need one of our best defenders, screw you, then what are you going to say if you're U.S. soccer or a U.S. soccer fan? Oh, darn, they didn't release him when they didn't have to? I mean, somebody at some point is going to have to pull that move, Eddie. They're going to have to finally say, no, we're not sending you one of our best players at a crucial time, because you know what? Our league's not going to break for you.
Yeah, I mean, I was openly rooting for U.S. soccer to get eliminated early. That way he could just come back sooner. And, I mean, I don't give a damn about the U-23s. I mean, no offense. I don't care. I care about my Red Bulls and now my players being held there when we had an agreement in place. And it's kind of like now I'm a little bit jaded. I find a little reason to get ticked off to find a rooting interest. I really don't want to root for Mexico because not only do I despise Mexico, but there are a lot of Twitter personalities that like Mexico, and they don't deserve happiness either. Like, you know, something like this kind of bothers me. So it's like, I honestly, genuinely
I gotta, can you please give me a name or two? I mean, come on, they're not going to care. Who are we talking about here?
Maxie Rodriguez.
Yes, I knew it. I knew that was coming. Man, I love that.
Ryan Rosenblatt, I can't stand Ryan Rosenblatt's writing.
Oh.
And, you know, it's just, there's more than them two, though. There's a lot. I'm not afraid.
Let's be fair. Rosenblatt is a U.S. fan who sometimes puts on the hat of general soccer fan and might have a soft spot for a good team or a team like Mexico. Whatever. I mean, I don't want to besmirch the U.S. soccer boosting reputation of Ryan Rosenblatt, but I get your point. All right, and I was just having fun with that because I know both those guys. You as a Costa Rica fan, I imagine what you have to ask yourself is whether you care how CONCACAF is represented come the Confederations Cup. If you don't care about the Confederations Cup, then I don't know how to help you. If you do care about the Confederations Cup, then you want the better team that's going to do better in Russia to win this game, right?
That's the thing. Who's the better team?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I could easily point to Mexico just based on, you know, talent.
I think
Mexico has more talent,
yes,
but they're not a team.
No, and that's been their traditional problem, hasn't it?
Yeah. So, and, you know, the U.S., do I want to see? I'm probably answering myself right now. Like, maybe if U.S. wins, then Klinsmann has to stay no matter what. There's no pressure, and you guys keep progressing.
Right? That is devious.
I might have answered my own question.
That is devious, my friend.
I'm looking out for number one.
You know, that's sort of the inverse of that question that I asked U.S. fans. Like, if you are if you are one of the people who doesn't think Jurgen Klinsmann is the right man for the job, if you are anti-Klinsmann, if you want to put it that way, I don't think it's that way to look at it. I think maybe if you just think that there is a better option or that Klinsmann's program's not working, would you accept a loss? Would you even want a loss if it guaranteed Klinsmann getting fired? I can't get myself around that ever because I'm a fan. I want my team to win. But I think people think that way sometimes, especially in this sport, Eddie. And that's you're kind of like, you have the benefit of not necessarily caring either way about Klinsmann's future, but you might find a way to reason out, well, if they win, Klinsmann stays, and I don't think Klinsmann's good at his job, and then maybe that hurts the U.S. long run, and that benefits my team.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are still relying on DeMarcus Beasley and Chris Wondolowski. Like, yeah. I can't see the progression of your program if these are the guys that you're still calling up. At least Costa Rica, like last night, they lose to South Africa, and they've been experimenting for about a year, and we got a lot of younger guys coming up. David Vegas, Venegas became a name. You know, Elias Aguilar, you know, just younger talent that we can rely on.
Well,
8 years from now, as opposed to, you know, DeMarcus Beasley, old ass, still trotting out.
Well, okay, of course, that's one of the frustrating things about Klinsmann, Eddie, is I think there's talent, maybe not left back. I mean, left back's always been a problem for the U.S. There are guys, I mean, you know, whatever you think of Greg Garza, he is a left back. There are guys, but I think there is talent coming. I think there's a gap, though. I think there is, there's a bit of a separation. Or Klinsmann's not the guy who is willing to go forward. He's done it in a couple of situations, but not a lot. I mean, he's obviously started to rely on Jassy Zardes, but, you know, there are other guys that, I mean, I don't know. It's such an odd mix that he's choosing to use. In certain places, he's committed to these older players who we know aren't going to be there come 2018. And in other spots, he's willing to throw out a guy like Ventura Alvarado, who not everybody believes in, and is 22, and is inexperienced, and sometimes makes a lot of mistakes. I mean, it's very frustrating.
I'm kind of glad that he experiments with guys like that. But Yarbrough's another one. Even Zardes, he plays Zardes out of position. Will Fatten had no idea what he was doing. Like, even when he gets young guys, he has no idea what to do with them. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a win-win for me.
Yeah, you're bumming me out, Eddie. Bumming me out, man. At least admit that the USA-Mexico thing is fun and that crowd's going to be just legit.
Well, yeah, because everybody's overhyping it. It really doesn't mean it. I mean, people, you believe this? People are actually asking the question, is this game one of the more important games in the rivalry's history? Like,
look, I think,
no, every but, World Cup qualifier ever is more important.
I don't agree.
The World Cup 2002 is more important than this.
Well, no,
game.
Okay, 2002, without a doubt, Eddie, that's the most important game USA and Mexico have ever played. But come on, even if the Confederations Cup doesn't matter, even if this game is created out of nowhere, conjured up by CONCACAF officials looking to put some more money in the coffers, at least admit that playing in a one-off situation with something on the line, no matter what it is, I mean, it could be a dollar, and the USA, that's gonna ratchet up USA-Mexico just a little bit more. It's already filled with that rivalry element. It's already filled with bragging rights. It's already filled with the intensity. Even if I don't think the state of the rivalry is what it used to be, there's still all of that history. There's still all of that loathing and hatred among the fan bases. I think this is up there. I mean, a World Cup qualifier, come on, Eddie. A World Cup qualifier between these two countries is one game out of 10 in a tournament that more than likely they're going to come out high enough in to qualify. I mean, that I know it matters, right. but I just don't know that it has the same sort of do or die element to it.
This entire thing, number one, was completely fabricated.
I just admitted that, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have value in the heads of the people playing game.
No, it doesn't, because what has U.S. done to warrant getting here? You guys won the B team tournament.
Sure, but that doesn't. That
three,
doesn't,
2 years ago, okay, right? And Mexico has won three of the last four.
But what does that have to do?
Mexico should go to confed anyway.
What does that? Okay, but that. But again, that's sort of secondary to the issue of what this game means in isolation, Eddie. I'm not saying that this is a. I'm not saying that this is a justifiable game for CONCACAF to hold. I'm not saying it's got some big value because of the way the Gold Cups happened. I'm not saying that the Confederations Cup is even that worthwhile of a prize. I'm just saying because it does have do or die, winner take all, whatever the all is, it has winner take all elements. I think it feels for them and for the fans, and that, and again, you know, you don't want to give CONCACAF credit for this, but they have created something that does have hype value, even if we're never going to see it again. I don't know if we'll ever see this again, and it might not, you know, the game itself might not deliver. We might not see anything out of it. I don't know. It's because the results have been so predictable in World Cup qualifying, which doesn't mean
it's probably because you guys are used to the mundane, the ordinary stuff. But even still, the foundation that this entire thing was built on, I can't get past that.
Okay.
I mean, even if you go to the Confederations Cup, who really cares? Because you're going to be playing against teams that don't really want to be there.
No,
Spain didn't want to be at the Confed Cup in 2013. They openly admitted that. The players didn't want to be there.
I understand that. I wrote something that's going up at U.S. Soccer Players today that talks about that very thing, that this is more than anything else, it's an exhibition tournament built on a bunch of friendlies. I mean, that's essentially what it is. When we get to Russia in 2017, and while that's true for Brazil, who's won the last three of them, it'll be true for Spain. It'll be true for Germany. It'll be true for whoever wins Euro next year. It's not necessarily true for the USA and Mexico. And while you're not going to give them the Mexicans or the Americans, whoever's there, tons of credit for winning a tournament and for going deep in a tournament that those teams don't care about, you do have to admit that the fact that USA and Mexico do care about that tournament adds to the value of this particular game tomorrow night. That's all I'm saying.
I can give you that.
Okay.
I can give you that.
Okay.
It's just ridiculously overhyped. And when people start comparing it to actual games that truly matter, that mean something, like, I think the real bragging rights is finishing the top of your group and qualifying. Like being number one,
okay,
that's true bragging rights. And then doing what you do in the World Cup, those are your bragging rights.
Okay, fair enough.
To me, this is just, this is just fabricated hype.
Okay, all right. Eddie doesn't like hype and fabricated hype. Eddie, appreciate the call, man. I don't know who you're going to root for, but, hope you enjoy the game at least.
I will. I think I talked myself into it. Go USA.
All right. There goes Eddie in Brooklyn. Good stuff from him. Everybody calling in today, guys, shirt numbers. I don't have them in front of me. I don't know what they are, but those are all regulars, and I appreciate every single one of you people. Thank you very much. Let's wrap this up. It's a good place to end on a Friday. Thank you very much for listening. Make sure you check out Rabble.tv tomorrow night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern time for USA Mexico. Myself, Jay Rodius, Jared Dubois will be on the mic at Rabble.tv. Covering that game, talking about, what do we call that? Broadcasting that game? We're not. We're rabbling that game. Can we verb that? I don't even know. I don't know what the actual, I don't know what you call it. But we'll be talking about that game while it's happening, while we watch it. You should join in. Rabble.tv. Look for it. We'll be tweeting out the link. from the Soccer Morning account, from the Best Soccer Show account, from the World Soccer Talk account, anywhere else that we can make it happen. All right. Am I done? I think I'm done, right? Yeah, I think I'm done. Thank you very much to Charlie Bone for his insight today. Hope that got you ready. Hope you're hyped up. Get your snacks or get yourself ready for whatever venue you're going to be watching it in. There's the theater thing happening. I don't know. Soccer Morning. We'll talk to you guys Monday. Bye.
Did my invitations disappear? What I put my heart on every curse.